A lack of boundaries can be a dangerous thing. I don't know if anyone has ever watched the TV show Fleabag. Last time I tried this when I was talking about Succession, nobody watched it. And Fleabag is a few years old now, so maybe you haven't watched it. And I should warn you, it is quite dark and crude. So it's definitely not for everyone. In fact, it took me a while to get into it. But Fleabag tells the story of a woman who has no or very little boundaries. She has sex with lots of men, even when she's in a relationship or knows they are in a relationship. She steals objects from her family home, and she is often in conflict with her family, who also cross lots of boundaries. It's very messy and destructive. As the show goes on, you see that this lack of boundaries comes out of grief. The loss of Fleabag's mother, and more recently the loss of her best friend. Grief and comedy and self-destruction are tied together. And Fleabag invites us as the viewers in, like literally she breaks the so-called fourth wall and regularly addresses us. Then in the second season of the show, Fleabag comes into contact with a very attractive looking priest. In some ways he seems quite normal, but in other ways he stands out because he wears distinctive clothing, because he is celibate. Because he really believes in God. These two very different people are drawn to each other. In fact, the creator of the TV show, Phoebe Fuller-Bridges, says, "I liked the idea of Fleabag meeting her match in someone with the same intelligence and wit she has, who leads a completely different life." Phoebe Fuller-Bridges herself said when she was younger, she dabbled in Christianity. And although she probably identifies more as an atheist now, there's a part of her that is still intrigued by the idea of people giving themselves to something bigger, believing. Even some of the Christian morals moves her. There's this tension in her and in the TV show between wanting to have boundaries and not wanting boundaries, believing, not believing. I think this tension is real for many people as we try to figure out who we are and who our people are. Where do you set the boundaries and when do you lower them? What helps us and our families and our communities to flourish? Today, it can be confusing and messy because we're kind of left to figure this out all by ourselves. Which is maybe why Leviticus can feel so jarring, because it is much more directive. It is all about boundary setting. And if we can remember the context, we begin to understand why this was so important. These laws are given to a people who have been slaves. I keep saying this every week, but I think it's really important to remember. These people have lived with a lack of boundaries. Their bodies open to abuse. They know how a lack of boundaries, how grief and destruction can be tied together. And now Yahweh has freed them and is forming them to be a new people, to give themselves to something bigger, welcoming them into a completely different life. Leviticus 18, verse 1. Yahweh said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, I am Yahweh your God. You must not do as they do in Egypt, where you used to live. And you must not do as they do in the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you. Do not follow their practices." Part of what is happening in Leviticus is that this group is being formed into a people, a nation that's meant to be different to Egypt, different to the other nations around them. Boundaries are being created, boundaries that Israel will hold on to with everything they have, because the experience of Israel, most of the time, will be one of struggle. They will be doing all they can to keep on existing, to not be wiped out. These markers are given and embraced because it invites them to believe in something bigger. It helps them to endure. In chapters 18 to 22, sometimes referred to as the Holiness Code chapters, we see what This means in the everyday, to live as God's people. Boundaries are given for every aspect of life, helping create a nation, a community that is bound together by these particular laws. For example, in Leviticus 19, it says, "You are to care for the poor. You are to speak the truth, pay people properly, ensure justice, look after your neighbor, keep the Sabbath, show respect to the elderly." Boundaries are seen to be the answer to the grief and destruction they've experienced. Can you see the appeal in having good boundaries? But Israel, like the priest in Fleabag, lives in this tension. They're trying to be distinct and keep God's boundaries, but also they're kind of normal. They look like other nations in many ways. And they're often tempted to be more like the nations, which some of the laws address. It says, "Don't sacrifice your children to Molech. Don't make idols from cast metal. Don't consult mediums. This is what the nations do. Don't do that." So there's some resistance to the nations around them, but in many ways, Israel is part of its time. Let me highlight this tension. Over 10 years ago now, I took a class on Old Testament ethics. I thought to myself, I love the Old Testament, I love ethics, perfect class to take. And in the class, we had the freedom to pick some ethic from the Old Testament and explore it. And somehow I ended up reading the laws in Deuteronomy around rape. I know, it's dark, and maybe that says something about me. But I ended up reading a text that I probably hadn't ever really read before in depth, and sit with the text. And it disturbed me. I mean, for example, one of the big debates I discovered was whether the Old Testament even had such a word for rape. Surely it must. Surely, I thought, it is clear that rape is a moral wrong and I'd find it condemned in the scriptures, God's good words to us. Or maybe there is some form mentioned, but definitely not how we'd define it today. And this really shook me. I felt this tension between my culture and this different ancient culture in the Bible. Reading the laws often feels like you're peering into a completely different life. What do you do with that? You might have had this same experience as we've been reading Leviticus, and particularly today as we look at Leviticus 18 and 22. It covers a whole range of behavior, including a lot of instruction around sex, and some of it makes sense and some of it might feel strange to us. Let's read some of the text. Leviticus 18, verse 7. "Do not dishonor your father by having sexual relations with your mother. She is your mother. Do not have relations with her. Do not have sexual relations with your father's wife. That would dishonor your father. Do not have sexual relations with your sister, either your father's daughter or your mother's daughter, whether she was born in the same home or elsewhere." I don't know if you noticed, and if you did, whether it was jarring, but all these instructions we just read are written to men. Don't have sex with your mother. Who are we talking to? Men. Women are not told to not have sex with their father. In fact, when you go through the whole list of prohibitions, this is the main prohibition that is not listed explicitly. It never says to fathers, don't have sex with your daughters, which is, you know, a little bit troubling. Verse 8, don't have sex with your father's wife. Who is this law addressing? Sons. Don't have sex with your sister. Who shouldn't? Brothers. And on it goes. These laws are directed to men, not to people like me. And not only that, but one of the reasons that are given for not having sex with female family members is because it brings dishonor to your fellow man. Don't have sex with your mother. Why? Because it dishonors your father. Don't have sex with your aunt. Why? Because it will dishonor your uncle. Don't have sex with your brother's wife. Why? Because it will dishonor your brother. There is one exception later in Leviticus 20 when it says if a man marries his sister, he dishonors her. But most of the time, men are dishonoring other men. This is a shame and honor culture where men are at the center of the circle. It's men who serve as priests. It's men who are encouraged to lift up other men. It's men that these laws are addressing. These boundaries in Leviticus are steeped in patriarchal imagination. And this was completely normal and unremarkable for most of history. It's only recently that women's voices are now considered. One of the reasons I started watching Fleabag was because it's created by a woman seeking to highlight a particular woman's experience. This is still considered unusual, groundbreaking. Many women would say that the absence of a female perspective in these laws has a way of damaging real people. Indeed, according to Leviticus 20, the consequences for breaking these laws fall on both parties, regardless of what happened, whether consent was given or not. The death penalty is to apply to both men and women. If a man has an affair with another man's wife, both the man and the woman are to die. If a man has sex with his father's wife, both are to die. If a man has sex with his daughter-in-law, both are to die. Less severe crimes, when other men are not dishonored, the penalty is to be cut off from Israel. For example, if a man has sex with his sister, both are to be cut off. If a man has sex with a woman who has her period, both are to be cut off. Now, in practice, it seems like these penalties weren't literally applied, at least not often. The point here is stability. These laws are designed to create stability, starting with the family. Boundaries are given so that families can flourish. Breaking the boundaries that are listed here are believed to destabilize the family unit, cause destruction. And I'm sure we would agree with many of these rules, right? Like incest is not good. It is destructive. This is a boundary that is still needed. But the way we talk about it today will be different. These boundaries in Leviticus are formed in a particular context. I would say a patriarchal context. So what does this mean for us now? This is the tension, isn't it? Do we copy these boundaries in Leviticus? Do we change them? What helps us and our families and communities to flourish? It starts to become a bit confusing. Some Christians try to create their own boundaries over these laws. They will divide the laws into categories and say there are ceremonial or ritual laws, like all the instructions around the sacrifices and the foods, and there are moral laws about what is wrong and right. Many Christians will discard the ceremonial laws, saying that Jesus has given us permission to do so, but want to keep the moral laws. It sounds nice, but actually it's hard to make that distinction because it's not a distinction that Leviticus makes. All of the laws are from God. All of these laws are to form a holy people. And even in the moral law section, do we still think it's a grave sin to have sex with a woman when she has her period? Is it okay to have a tattoo? How bad is it to curse your parents? See the tension? Where do you draw the boundaries? How much can we change the boundaries? What does it mean for us now? Let me touch on something even more controversial than how we view women and men. Because there's another boundary marker here in Leviticus 18 and also Leviticus 20, which has generated a lot of interest in recent years. Leviticus 18, verse 22. Do not have sexual relations with a man as one does with a woman. That is detestable. Homosexuality. Is it wrong? This feels like one of the big issues of our time. And there is grief and confusion wrapped up in this discussion. This debate has a way of damaging real people. So if I say something here, please come and talk to me afterwards if you need to. I can't answer this question fully, right now, because you'd have to look at the whole Bible, and we're just looking at one section at the moment. But most Christians have been pretty firm for most of our history that homosexual acts are wrong. Because here it is, right? In Leviticus, described as detestable. Some translations call it an abomination. That sounds like pretty strong language. Why is it forbidden? I think for a long time I assumed it was because it crossed a boundary around procreation. Sex, especially in the Old Testament, is wrapped up in the need for children. You want to form a new nation, you need children. And perhaps that is part of it. But do you notice that this law is again only directed to men? Sex between women is never addressed or condemned in the Old Testament. Reading First Feminists, and then in more recent years listening to gay Christians like Matthew Vines, got me looking at these instructions in a way I never had before. Now, you may disagree with what I'm about to say, and in some ways it feels a little dangerous to say this in a Baptist church where the boundaries on this debate are so tight, I'm not meant to talk about this. But there are some who would argue that the real boundary that is being crossed in Leviticus is when a man is treated as a woman. This is what is so terrible. When men are submissive sexual partners, like women are meant to be, this dishonors all men. This is taboo, detestable. Remember, this is a patriarchal context. Women are inferior to men. And it's interesting, actually, when you look at ancient interpreters, this is how they understood this passage. Ancient interpreters like Philo understood Leviticus to be condemning men for becoming too feminine. I'd never considered how patriarchy could also be damaging to men. And I hadn't really considered who else was experiencing exclusion when it came to these laws. For men to be associated with the feminine disgraced them. Now, this is a common belief in the ancient world. So here we are in the tension again. What boundaries are unique to Israel? And what boundaries do they have which are kind of similar to other nations around them? This law kind of is very similar to surrounding nations. So what are we to do with them? I think we begin by acknowledging that there are different cultural contexts. Our context is different to the one in Leviticus. I think we need to acknowledge that so we can begin the hard work of working out what boundaries are needed now. And I think we need to place Leviticus and its laws in the wider biblical story and ask, is God's vision for humanity a patriarchal one? Some might say yes. But Vines, arguing no, says, yes, ancient Israel was dominated by patriarchal structures and norms, which we see reflected throughout the Old Testament, including in its prohibitions of male same-sex intercourse. The verses reflect the inferior value that was commonly accorded to women in ancient times, not just their subordinate status in those societies. But far from being a reason to view scripture as outdated or sexist, the Bible itself is what points us towards a path where patriarchy is no more. If patriarchy isn't the end vision, then what does this mean for the boundaries we create now? Well, Leviticus teaches us that boundaries are important. Good boundaries help look after our own bodies. Good boundaries can protect families. Good boundaries protect communities. But boundaries can also exclude and damage, so we need to check them. When Jesus came, Jesus had this delightful habit of widening the boundaries, inviting the unexpected into God's people. As a church, we seek to follow Jesus, to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And yet that doesn't mean we avoid the tension. We still have to ask this question. When do you set the boundaries and when do you lower them? It is confusing and messy as we work out, what does this mean as individuals? What does this mean for us as a church? And I want us to have a conversation this year exploring these types of questions. But for now, let me reiterate. I think Leviticus shows us how boundaries are important. We need markers. We need God to direct us into the good life. But Leviticus also reminds us that all the boundaries we set will be partly shaped by the culture we are in. Even in the Bible, we see boundaries changing over time, sometimes becoming harder and inflexible, other times relaxing and opening up. When it comes to sex and gender and marriage, these often seem to be where the most passion is expressed because sex and gender are crucial to our identities, to the relationships we have with one another, to the family unit, which is the building block from which communities are formed. These are complex questions we need to wrestle with. But I hope that as we sit in this tension as Christians, we will be able to offer something distinctive to a world where less and less people have boundaries. I hope we form good boundaries that protect and bring life. And more important than all of that, I hope that we will be able to point people to Jesus in the way that we live, in the way that we treat each other. I hope that people will see something in our communities that intrigues them to want to know God more. God, the one full of grace and life. Let me pray.